Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Strength Academy Podcast. Once again, it's Mundo here, joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
And so, on episode 61, right?
Yes, yeah, that's 61, correct.
We have a special guest for you. His name is Mike Mansour, and he's been a weightlifting staple in the community for quite a long time, and he's also got some other hobbies that are of interest as well. And we just want to talk to him, kind of get his experiences down on recording, and just talk to him about what his experience in the past has been, and share some of his upbringing in the weightlifting community and some of what he does now. And we'll go ahead and get started with Mike. So how are you doing today, Mike?
Fine, thank you very much.
Just to get to know you a little bit, tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you started weightlifting, what you're doing now, and like what you have in mind for the future of your weightlifting career.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I actually saw the 1976 Olympics on TV that was in Montreal, and I got interested in the weightlifting. And so I sought out a coach up at Dartmouth College named Carl Wallen, and he coached me for the first year or so on how to actually become a competitive weightlifter. And so I started lifting at a place called the Fountain of Youth Health Spa, and I was actually being sponsored by them back in 76, and I still have the same weightlifting belt from back then.
Okay.
That they got me. So, but anyway, I started there, and I started competing throughout New England, and you know, I still hold a lot of state records from Vermont and senior New England records as well from snatch and clean and jerk back in the days when it was a 65 and a half kilogram class. And but I started going to regional championships, and then I didn't start going to nationals until actually the first one was 1984. It was a drug-free event, all natural competition, so they tested you right there. So I actually got the silver medal was in total. And clean and jerk was a gold. Okay. And snatch was a bronze. And so I think I clean and jerked 120 back then. But you couldn't pick up your medal until you went down with the doctor and made a specimen for the 100 cc's of urine. So you stood right there, and my parents and my daughter were out in the audience waiting for me to come back out. But that was one time you wanted to make sure you went to those meets.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't go to the meets, you're kind of like showing off that you may not have been clean. And so I got through that really well. And it was just from then on, I started going to the Masters in 1989 when I turned 35. It was the first year that they went to the 35 to 39 age group. And they were experimenting with it to see what a turnout they'd have.
Okay.
And so that was great because I got to go and compete at a national level at that point. And I think I got a bronze medal at that one too, but it was great because they voted in the 35 to 39 age group at that point.
At that time, yeah.
That's where it started.
Okay.
And then, so I won it in 93, the nationals, in my, I think it was a 40 to 44 at that point. And the Pan American Games, I won a Masters gold medal in 2001. And then I got to go to the Worlds in 2003 and got a bronze medal in that.
So where was that at?
That was in Savannah.
In Savannah, Georgia?
Georgia, yeah. Okay. And so that was really exciting because to be part of that where you've got all these different countries and all the different flags are on the stage. I mean, it was,
yeah.
I have a video of it. Thank goodness my wife took a video of it. So I managed to save that over the years. But it's been a great ride. I'm still doing it now, but of course at a much less weight. I mean, I've got a bad left hip that I want to have replaced in June. June 16th is the date of that surgery.
Okay.
So maybe after that, then I can come right back to, lifting, maybe not so much full squat snatches, but we'll see.
But still lifting.
Still lifting. I don't want to give that up at all. It's carried me so well over the years health-wise. I mean, I don't, I haven't drank since 1975, and so I've been able to keep that going, and it's just, it's been a great health ride with me too. I mean, I coach anybody that needs assistance when I go to a gym, and just, I'm not as good a coach as people like Grayson is, but at least I have a lot of experience that I can help start people on and say, look, this worked for me or it didn't work for me. So, but it's a fun event. I look at weightlifting as great, athletic, and because it involves not only strength, but speed and flexibility.
Right.
And powerlifting doesn't offer that. And bodybuilding doesn't offer that.
Right.
So you've got a really good event to have people going on. And my number is number 673. I registered for the in the USWF back then in 1976, so I've got a very low number.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it's still, you got to keep it valid over the years. I guess you never lose it. I guess it stays with you, but I've never not been a member.
All right. So along the lines of what worked and what didn't work, so what did work for you? Like, what helped you progress in your training and get to the levels that you needed to make those, some of those gold medals and some of those medal attempts? Like, what was going on in your training that helped you facilitate that?
Really, I did a lot of bicycle riding, you know, and hiking. I was a great hiker and a rock climber as well. So a lot of that stuff, I feel the balance portions of it, plus some cardiovascular stuff. And I've also been an active caver over the years. I started that in 1968. And that means rope work underground and dealing with rock climbing and carrying heavy backpacks. Like in Lachigia Cave, you're carrying bolt gear to make climbing moves or bolt ladders.
Sure.
And heavier battery packs and drills and stuff. So the pack is just up to 60 pounds. Back in my 40s, I was carrying packs like that. So I kind of had a well-rounded, I wouldn't say athletic, but at least an active base to work with.
Well, it's that general physical preparedness, right?
Yeah.
Kind of just in shape to do the training.
And they helped each other. I mean, it kind of balanced. I mean, the Olympic weightlifting, of course, gave me some strength and agility to work in some of the caving moves that I had to do. So, you know, it's been really good. I wouldn't change anything, except maybe I don't like to run, but the bicycle part, I would have done more of that, too.
Okay.
Or I hike a lot, too, so I can't really say that it's not enough, but I would do more bicycling because it's good for the knees.
Okay.
You know, that's been a problem too in the last 10 years. I've had knee problems too. So,
okay.
But the bicycle part of the thing helps make those a little more mobile.
Sure. So just like staying active in other areas of your life helped your Olympic weightlifting.
Yes, exactly.
And vice versa.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. And so like what didn't work for you? Like what did you find in your training that was like, maybe I should back off doing this, or maybe this isn't the right approach for me?
Did you fall into the Bulgarian method when the craze swept the country, that's what these guys were up to? Or,
well, I know that too many reps for me didn't work, you know, as far as Olympic lifting. So doubles and triples were probably the most I'd want to do. I was doing, you know, sets of five for a long time, the deadlifts and the Romanian deadlifts and squats, but it caused more of a longer recovery period between that and the next workout. You know, I was trying to stiff, especially in the 30s and 40s when I got there.
Yeah.
But that didn't quite so much work. It's a lot of reps. So I've kind of gone back to the doubles and triples right now. Because, I don't know, some people are advocates of going reps of 10, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just that, I don't know, you kind of start losing some of your technique at that point.
Sure.
And it may not help your recovery between workouts.
Yeah, and I understand that because I'm a master's lifter too, and I get like the volume. Sometimes that reduction in volume helps you recover better just overall. And
yeah.
So like, yeah, I know what you mean by like having the volume all the time. As you get older, it's a little bit harder to maintain. So
yeah.
It's just like backing off some of that stuff really helps you stay in better condition. And
absolutely.
Just stay in the game a little bit longer.
Yep. Yeah, that's what you want too. You want to do it as long as you can. I mean,
right?
Look at some of these masters lifters; they're lifting in their 90s.
Right.
You know, so let's. I'm 65, so let's focus on that. Maybe we could.
Yeah, let's make it the goal.
You know. Yeah.
For sure.
So when you were starting out, that the early training program where you were first working with that coach, what was your beginner program? What was popular at the time? What was the kind of method you guys were using?
He was really into the leg strength, the squats, and it wasn't quite so much the technique at that time. In fact, but we were lifting with metal weights in the Leverone Fieldhouse at Dartmouth.
Okay.
So he couldn't drop them. And there wasn't even rubber pads on his platform because he was the track coach and he had to let people do a strength thing there. But
sure.
But you couldn't drop the weights. So here I was dealing with clean and jerks of maybe 230, 240 pounds back then.
Okay.
And you had to break the bar up to set it down. And that was tough. So eliminated a lot of the reps. You couldn't
right.
do a lot. But it was so loud in there. I remember just the clanging inside this tiny little room. It was a little bit bigger than this. But, you know, that was looking back, it was hard. But that's all I had to work with until I went to that Fountain of Youth health spa. And, of
sure.
course, they had a cement floor in this fitness center. And so I had to end up buying some bumper plates, the Krybergs that I have, the 25 kilograms, that I brought in there every time I wanted to work out so I could drop the weights
sure.
in this carpeted room. And but it was... It was one of those things where you got to be really careful because you're not. I didn't have my own place, my own gym where I could make a nice little platform to drop And but I know it was tough at first because he wanted to keep on the squats and the deadlifts, and I think he had Romanian deadlifts were on there too. And there was a wall where he had people's progress and stuff and the thing. So you're kind of like ready to start making improvements because other people saw what you were doing week to week, which is actually kind of worked, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of provides like a little bit of like a competition in the gym and just kind of like motivates people to kind of, he's catching up to me. I should push a little bit harder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So okay.
That was a motivator.
Well, that's always kind of fun. When you were really pushing hard on the squat, what were your kind of average squat workouts looking like?
As a 67.5 kilogram class, actually it was 148.75. That's what I called it because I didn't like to convert over to the kilos because back then it was more pounds than that. Oh, but you had to start converting because that's what a lot of the meets were done.
Sure.
But I was doing sets of five with the 325. In the back squat too, so
dang, that's pretty good. Yeah,
it was lots of fives. Yeah,
lots of fives, which I didn't like it, but you know, and I was doing some bench presses too, which I'm not a strong advocate, but that's what you're doing just to kind of build the strength for your shoulders and so forth. And
yeah, we don't do a whole lot of bench pressing in our programs either. It is
a lot more
like an accessory work more than anything. Yeah. Like it's not usually main lift.
Yeah,
that we work on. But yeah, I'll do like dumbbell pressing and some other things like that. But
I still do those now.
Yeah, right.
At home, but I don't like the bar because you're not flexible.
Right.
You're not having to cause that balance between each arm. It just works so much better. But yeah.
So, how long overall has been your experience with weightlifting? Like, you started at
76.
76.
Yeah.
And then you're still doing it to this day.
Yes.
So over 40 years.
That's right.
Like, okay, so you've been doing it for a long. What's kept you interested in the sport of weightlifting this long?
I think just the camaraderie that I have with all the older lifters. I mean, it's fun to go to these national meets and you have people you competed against for years and it's fun. It's more of a camaraderie team thing going on. And in the early days, it was just me against others. You know, you walk into the meet and, you know, people are either looking at you and thinking, oh my goodness, he showed up or something like that. But it's more to have the fun that's going on now. But back in 76, it was, there was different meets they held too back then. They actually had a couple of meets. My first trophy was in a meet where they had the clean and jerk and the bench press.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a strange thing. And so I can't remember how I placed, but that's the first trophy I remember getting.
All right.
And the Pine Tree Open was in 77. So I remember I got a best lifter in that one. But it started from all these different lifts. And finally, you had to stay with the Olympic lifting because they did offer like at least one meet a month if you wanted to go.
Okay.
Either state meet, regional meet, or something invitational. And I loved it so much, I just wanted to go to them all. I mean, I didn't really cycle right because it was my own. At that time, I was doing it on my own.
Sure.
So I just went to every meet.
Okay.
You know, one of these brute force things. You just want to kind of be part of that thing and see how well you do.
Yeah, for sure. And that, I think that's what a lot of people do when they get started. They get the bug to compete. They want to like get as much of experience as they can. And then as time goes on, they get a little more advanced and the PRs come a little less often. So they stretch out that competition schedule a little bit over time. Yeah. So another thing that I wanted to ask you is like was there a certain point in time in training where just like, all right, I know I'm just not going to be able to maintain the level of competition that I was training at. Like, at what point did you decide, okay, this is going to be more for fun and I'm going to actually try to, like, beat other people at this sport?
Then I became in a master's program, but I actually went to Lake Placid Olympic Training Center for a week in 84.
Okay.
And so I was the oldest one there, 30 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so, but they had double sessions every day. You had a morning and afternoon session, and it was balanced with cardio, and you had these three strength of these coaches, Rudy Sablo, Morris Ricebro, and I forgot the last guy. But anyway, they had us on this rigid program. And I remember somewhere during the week, I had hurt my wrist on a clean. And so they took me in and I had some ultrasound done on it. The pain was gone. I was able to go right back lifting in. So I was thinking, wow, this is really cool. At that level, they have all this stuff at their fingertips, you know, the medical training and stuff. But that was a good, rigorous program. And I thought, you know, it's probably too tough to keep going at a high level at that point when I became 30.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty, I mean, I think that's kind of fair because you have to balance, you know, career and, you know, family and these sort of things that kind of all pile up. So what are some of the, like you said, you know, that first meet was, you know, like a bench press and a clean and jerk. Yeah. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in the sport over the last, well, obviously there's the huge expansion that we've seen in the last 10 years. But like, so what, like even, you know, in regards to technical standards or, you know, program complexity, what are some of the things that you think have like really kind of changed since you started?
Well, there obviously was no CrossFit programs back then, but it was just coming back from not having the third lift, which is the press.
The press, okay.
They used to have the press competed with the snatch and clean and jerk. And so I never really got into the press because I didn't have to back then. Otherwise, to compete, you would have had to do it.
Sure.
But that has changed, and it was really, you were thinking more of the weight classes in pounds, and you had to convert to the kilograms. That was a big deal.
Okay.
And, and a lot of meets just had metal plates, you know. And finally they started coming around with the bumper plates, which is really good. That was, I don't remember when that started happening. I guess after.
I think York started developing bumper plates like in that era.
Too. Yeah,
like, well, they were the first ones to kind of develop those rubber,
yeah,
like standardized bumper plates.
But most people hadn't bought them because,
right,
they were too expensive or whatever, and
yeah,
so they didn't use the metal weights. So that getting rid of the metal weights was a good thing. And I don't remember so much about the programs being, they were intense, but they didn't have a lot of cardio stuff that I remember.
Sure.
I mean, people weren't, they were eating meat and potatoes, you know, they,
right,
were talking about that stuff. The diet wasn't a big thing. It was having a lot of calories, and you didn't have all these other different diets that they've got now for people,
sure,
to follow. And then it started becoming more of a diet thing, and there was a lot of different programs out there for your weightlifting. You could your assistance exercises,
right?
You know, you could do a lot of push presses or jerks in the rack and things like that. I mean, people started adding things to the program over the 80s, and that's where I started seeing where it was tough if you didn't select it right, because you could burn yourself out doing one particular thing or,
sure,
trying out something new and get hurt at it.
Right.
And then it just became, the CrossFit started getting involved. Well, actually, that was in the 2000s. But I don't remember a huge change, because you still had the basic lifts.
Sure.
And you never got away from the snatch, clean, and jerk, and the pulls and the jerks. And there wasn't a lot of pressing, you know. I just didn't feel that that was necessary, but some people believe in it. But,
right.
And I still to this day don't so much believe in it. I think it's too much of a stress on your shoulders.
Okay. So as far as like diets and things go, was there something that you followed that helped you maintain weight? Because like you still had to fit into a weight class. So,
yes,
how did you go about like managing your weight and kind of like constructing the way you fed yourself to fuel your workouts?
Yeah, I mean, I had three balanced meals, but I kept about 2 or 3 pounds above of the weight class.
Okay.
So you didn't have to cut too much. There was a lot of guys that were up to 10 pounds even 4 or 5 days before, and they just cut it on fluid weight.
Oh,
but
yeah,
then you're cramping up in the,
right,
meats.
Right.
You know, your calves muscles.
We've all seen that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seen that,
so you don't let that happen, or you just, and I ended up in the 165 pound classes a lot of times because my weight wanted to be there more than it did in the 65s,
sure,
or 67s rather. But it's just, I didn't really watch a huge diet when I was younger. I mean, I just kind of liked to eat well and just, you know, I mean, again, I didn't drink alcohol, so,
right,
I was kind of like, I didn't smoke, so I didn't have to worry about health, things like that. But it was, I didn't eat a lot of junk either. I mean, I didn't eat, you know, really a lot of potato chips and things that would be considered fattening and,
sure,
and useless calories. But, you know, the older you get, the more you're concerned about that.
Yeah.
That's what I've been working on in the last 10 years, is thinking about the health part of that, the,
okay,
cholesterol and things, you know.
Well, I know that, like, in the past, like, bodybuilding and things like that, they've had that gallon of milk a day type of diet.
No.
Like, that kind of stuff. Did you ever do that kind,
no,
of thing?
No, I didn't, but I knew guys that did. I knew guys that did, and they took iron supplements.
Yeah,
I mean, my goodness sakes. Unless you're losing iron, that's,
right,
not a good thing to add a lot in your system. But they were big. Take iron this and take iron supplements. It was kind of scary because you could be iron toxic at some point.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that you kind of also saw the rise of the supplement industry as a whole.
Yes,
Vitamins
first, and then
and
other stuff along with it too, calcium.
Liver capsules, right? Those were.
I never
one
tried
of the,
that, but they were there. You're
they,
right.
They're, I know
the
that those.
Capsules?
Yeah, so they were marketing this, you know, desiccated liver in a capsule.
Oh, that was
and you were supposed to be taking, you know, four or five of them twice a day or something like that.
Yeah, that was the liver.
And what was that supposed to do?
I mean, liver's got a lot of those, a lot of vitamins and minerals in it.
Right.
And I guess they said, you know, people would rather take this as a pill than sit down and eat a slice of liver.
I mean, liver doesn't taste great.
I mean, it's an acquired taste. But yeah, so I think that was one of the early kind of supplements. But it's one of those things that I, you know, warn lifters about now is you know, it's like, well, if guys like yourself were able to you know, lift big weights without what specific kind of pre-workout or micronized creatine or what version of protein, it's like, no, I think just eat food.
And
don't worry so much about the supplementation is one of the things that I try to get people to kind of buy into a little bit. And it's good to hear that, yeah, you don't need to mess with a lot of it.
Didn't need it. Did not need it. No.
Was there anything like in your training that helped you, like recovery methods? Like in your training, like what would you do to recover? Would you just sleep more, eat more? Like how would you approach recovering from all the things that you were doing?
Stretching, or sauna, that sort of stuff?
Was there
any
kind of
meditation? Didn't get into that. No. I wasn't really in need of it. And, you know, I was just plain active in other things like caving and stuff that kept me going. And at that time, there was a period of time at Dartmouth College, I worked nights. There were 2 to 10:30 at night, so I had to specifically sleep at a certain time.
Oh, okay.
You know, in order to be able to do the lifting in the morning, which, you know, the training in the morning, you know, I got used to that for 16 years when I was there.
Okay.
But no, I didn't do anything special to recover, not that I remember. I mean, if I was stiff, I'd stretch. But I didn't really have that kind of a problem, you know, being active and everything.
So do you think, like, athletes these days are spoiled with the amount of things that are thrown at them as far as, like, recovery, nutrition, supplementation, programming? Like, do you think they get catered to a little more, or do you think they just have too much on their plate to, like, they're not sticking to the basics, like the meat and potatoes of, like, their programming? Like, the stuff that you went through, you know, you when you start your training program, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to eat regular and then just go to sleep at a decent time.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was any extraneous stuff, like, all that we have today, like, do you think it helps them, or is it more of a hindrance?
I think it's a hindrance because you have too many choices.
Okay.
You know, if you walk into a library and you get a certain subject you're looking for, it is 1,000 volumes, and you got to pick which one's going to work. I mean, there's too many things to choose from. I mean, great, you can experiment, but I mean, it takes a long time for one of these things to work, 6 to 7 months to a year, to see the benefits of that. And by that time, you may have messed up your training. So, I mean, they've got these choices now, and they've got you know, the internet at the disposal. I didn't have that back then. You know, you just went to the gym and you worked out and you focused on winning things all the time and not worrying about, did I eat enough of this particular food or let's eat this supplement. That's an unnecessary worry, in my opinion.
Sure.
Worry about
missing the forest for the trees, you know?
Yeah.
Modern day lifters will have a minor shoulder tweak or something like that, and then all of a sudden they're Googling, I got rotator cuff surgery coming up, and instead of just letting it rest and just like rehabbing it a little bit,
you worked through
it.
That's what we did. I mean, unless you heard of it, they had things like ultrasound. Right. It was just, in my opinion, that was like magic.
Okay.
It worked, but you know, those same basic things. You're right. If they get a little problem right now and they look online for a solution or something or surgery, I mean, a lot of us heal through that stuff.
Right.
But
yeah, well, I mean, they've done a few studies where they did a placebo rotator cuff repair, where they just put them under and then nicked them, but didn't actually fix anything, and they healed at about the same rate as the people they actually stitched it back together for if they did their PT.
I betcha.
The fact that placebo surgeries works is just kind of like terrifying, in that it's like we might be doing a lot of unnecessary
stuff.
Things.
That's so true.
Because the first, resist the MRI, guys. Resist the MRI unless it's absolutely necessary.
If you can't walk or you can't do anything, you know, I tore mine completely. I had to completely repair the thing in 2007, and I was unable to comb my hair. I couldn't make that motion, so I knew there was something really wrong, and they showed me on the MRI. But if you just get, I mean, a sore stiffness or something like that, jeepers, it's part of life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in my opinion, I mean, that's just, unless it's, but sometimes it pays to get a medical opinion too. I mean, you don't want to work through something that is damaging, but I mean, I just know that sometimes you can kind of look too, analyze too much about yourself.
Yeah. That's true. I've noticed that sometimes, like, people, especially weightlifters, are a little bit over analytical about what's going on. They get in their heads a lot about, like, the way they lift or the way something feels. So I could see how that medical field would kind of, like, draw them into making conclusions that way too.
Yes,
so
it would.
One thing I'm curious about is, in your training, people run into this quite a bit, and I'm wondering if you had any strategies that you used as a mental block when it comes to a certain weight. Like, a lot of times for people, like, you know, the 200-pound snatch or the 400-pound squat, like, these sort of things get to be numbers that you're kind of apprehensive about. Or did you ever have any, like, blocks at a certain weight where you couldn't do that one, but you could do 1 pound more or 1 pound less? Like, did you ever have any of those?
Interesting you bring that up, because the 200 snatch was a barrier for me until somehow, I guess I went to 205, and somehow somebody said, oh, he'll never do that. And that spurred me on, I think, more than anything. Just you against the weight. When somebody tells you you can't do something, it seemed to work better for me. But after I broke that, I remember a good many meets in the early 80s, my opener was 92.5.
Okay.
203. And snatch. And so, you know, I got by that, but it was just, it was a barrier. I remember that being a barrier.
So how did you work through that? Like, what did you do to kind of, like, mentally prepare yourself for taking those lifts, or just working through the numbers themselves?
Just knowing I could do it, I think.
Just knowing you could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Once I hit 205, I went to 205 from 195, and I don't know what that day motivated me to do that, but it worked. I just felt good or something. But once I broke that barrier, then you know you've got there, and then just another step on the stairwell of success is just, not a big deal.
So the strength was there, it's just the confidence and the knowing, the knowing ability, like that lack of fear of the unknown kind of helped you develop past that point.
Well, that 200 makes a big sound, you know, especially when you're small. If you're a big guy, way more than that, but that was a lot more than I weighed. So you're right, that was a barrier. Yeah. I just remember how excited I was when I finally broke it. And that was fun.
Yeah, because that's like a milestone, right? For a lot of people, it's just like, oh yeah, I got, like, especially on the lower weight classes, if you can hit a 200 pound lift as a lighter, weight class lifter, it's a huge accomplishment, I think. Yeah. Like, to me, it is.
Yeah.
But there's always numbers that mess with people. And was there ever one in the clean and jerk, or was it more in the snatch?
Well, I think 250 was 250. A barrier. And then there was a number of meets, and then I started opening it at 259.
Okay.
117.5. I mean, it just was easy once I got past that point. It was just that was a barrier too. I remember that thing. But there's a key to that too, I remember. If you think of it in kilos versus pounds, then it's not a big deal, because, you know, 203 is the next increment on the 200-pound barrier. It's 92.5. So you're thinking, well, that doesn't sound like much. And I might have tricked myself into thinking that.
Right.
And that's how I did it. But, in the same way with the 117, 259 was past it. Or 253 is 115, I guess it is. Yeah. But if you think in kilograms, you can kind of trick yourself, I think.
It's lighter than it actually
is. Yeah, mentally, it's just a smaller number.
Right, yeah.
Did you ever do any visualization practice?
Oh yeah,
that sort of stuff.
The completed lift. Yes.
Can you describe the technique that you use for that for us? What kind of ways did you use to? Were you a first person or third person perspective? I'm always interested to know, like, what people's techniques are for when they visualize things.
I just know that I saw the completed lift locked out over my head, and that I would do just before I picked the bar up. I would just kind of close my eyes and think that.
Imagine the finish, not the lift.
Finish, so you think through it. Isn't that kind of like a person chopping a board with a karate chop? They think through the board. You think through that.
Interesting. So you the lift's already completed. You're just seeing yourself already completed.
You see it completed. You're standing there waiting for the down signal.
Okay. So everything that has already happened, you're just you're imagining the already done.
Yes, I was successful with myself working that. I mean, that was kind of a way to see through it.
And so, as Grayson was describing, would you see yourself locked out from this position as if you're looking out in the crowd, or would you see yourself like as a camera angle?
That's
almost
interesting. I think I just looking out over the crowd, having done it.
Okay.
Yeah, not looking at myself, but looking at the crowd, you know, knowing that, waiting for the down signal, you know, that's the final thing.
Yeah, looking down at that center judge and just waiting for that.
Yeah, waiting for the down signal. Yeah, yeah. That's because you the rest of it kind of is so routine. You've done so many thousands of those lifts that you don't worry about the clean or the jerk, as long as you just want to see it finished.
Right.
And thinking of it locked out is a good trick, because if you don't, you can end up with a press out.
Sure.
You know, if you're thinking at this point, when you've got set before your jerk, you start to drive it up over your head. If you don't think of it being completed, how are you going to lock it out?
It's a good strategy.
I like that. Sometimes when we talk to people about, well, you know, it's like, I want you to try visualizing your lifts, they have a really hard time because their brain makes them miss in their heads.
Yeah.
So like they're trying to go through the pull, and all of a sudden they're pulling into their toes early in their head, and they're like, I don't know how to finish the lift. But
like, how do you fail in your imagination, guys? Come on.
But I think that starting at the end is a really good way to just say, no, just picture yourself standing there with the weight over your head and the right plates on the bar, and that might be a really good place to start.
Yeah, like that for people that are starting out, I think that imagining what the end of the lift looks like or feels like, having it locked out overhead, looking, waiting for that down signal is probably a better way to approach it than trying to imagine every single detail leading up to it. That's a little
more advanced.
Yeah.
You get to pull as high as you can, and then catch up, and then stand up, and then think of the jerk. But you think of all those steps, you've now confused yourself, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think thinking is the, you know, when we get new people in, it's you know, you're going to have to think about this a lot for the first 3 months, and then you'll have to think about it a little bit less every week after that.
When we train people, we develop that athletic nature of autonomy by helping them develop which lifts are going to become more automatic and which ones they're going to have to think about a little more. And so when we learn new technique, they have to think about it a little more. But as time goes on and they get the reps, just like you mentioned, like overall, they get a huge amount of reps under their belts. And then over time, that becomes automatic. You don't have to
think automatic. About it. You don't have to think about how high you're pulling it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there. You just do the lift. Think of it being done.
Okay. That's a good strategy. I like that. That's good to know.
So from your training, are there any... you know, competition or training, any particular lifts that you're the most proud of? Maybe like one or two of the classic lifts, and then any, were you a master at any accessory exercises? Like you could do more pull-ups than anybody in the gym or?
Well, as a climber, I've always done chin-ups. And so to this day, I do chin-ups with dumbbells attached to me with one of the belts. So I was doing, up to 5 years ago, I was doing 10 strict chin-ups with 60-pound dumbbell.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
I still do them with 20 pounders at home now.
Okay.
10 sets. But that keeps your upper body strength. I mean, you know, just that's something I never really lost. But, you know, climbing and Olympic lifting, I mean, it's great. I think it's great to do that.
That's a huge set of 10 on the chin-up.
Yeah.
I've done some fives in that range, and it's not very easy.
No, you just have to do it strict though. I mean, you can't cheat. Cause if you cheat, then But these are chin-ups, not, you know, palms away, not palms to you. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. I think, yeah. So palms forward. Yeah.
Palms forward.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to ask you is, like, how would you approach your training? So would you take it, like, real seriously? Would you joke around? Would you kind of, like, have fun and train with other people, or just mostly by yourself? Like,
myself.
What was your philosophy towards your training? Like, what would you... How would you approach it?
Very regimented.
Very regimented.
Start at the same time.
Okay.
You know, have the same calorie intake before you do a workout. I mean, like for me now, I'm lifting right about 5 o'clock at night. I have 2 hour workouts.
Okay.
So, but 5 o'clock, make sure, because that's a good goal. Because if you don't have a little goal to when to get to the gym,
sure.
Other things going to take some priority on the way in. You may go do something on the way. Get there at a certain time and be regimented and develop a habit. And that habit seems to carry you through. But in the gym, I mean, I don't like to socialize and talk because it takes away from your routine. And
sure.
If you're supposed to be thinking about your workouts, you get into a conversation with somebody else. That always used to annoy me in the gym, where somebody come up and started asking you. I mean, that was so nice that they were considerate about that.
Right.
But it took you away from your concentration.
Sure.
And so I enjoyed more focused and going off in the corner somewhere, because that worked for me.
Would you like listen to music while you train, or was it just mostly
silence?
I like background noise.
Yes, always.
Yeah, and especially if there's dropping a lot of like heavy metal plays and stuff like that, all that stuff in the background kind of just gets to drown out some of that noise.
It does.
All right. So do you have like a favorite meet or a favorite, story, something you got to watch in person, or favorite competition you did, like something that stands out to you as one of your fondest memories?
I think so. It was the 2001 National Championship, National Masters, where this guy, Chris Waterman, used to always beat me. I'd always come in second with him, and he was from Ohio. And that particular meet, there was three of us. And so I forgot the other fellow's name, but by the end of the snatches, I had snatched 77, and I think he had done 80, and the other guy had done 80. So I was 2.5 kilograms back, and the clean and jerk came along. Ended up, we opened at 100, and then all three of us did 105. And then so Chris went to 107 and missed it. And so here I was, here's the chance to win if I go to 110.
Okay.
And I had it almost locked out. And I went, I've got a video of it. And I started falling forward, but I would have won that thing and beaten him for the first time. Oh, it was so close. But we watched the video, my wife and I, now, and it was something. But all three of us, first, second, and third place, were only 2.5 kilograms apart.
Oh, that's a good meet.
That was a good meet. Yeah, he even said that on the announcer, even said that. But,
if I that makes for an exciting session.
That was like something.
When you have to try to beat somebody by a couple kilos.
It was just so close. And it was such a big thing for me to win this guy. I mean, he's a nice guy, but I just wanted to at least once. But I did out clean. I mean, the clean was nothing.
It was good. Okay.
The jerk was just quite a little bit ahead, and I just had to run to catch it, and I almost dropped it in the judge's lap. So, but okay. The video shows that. It's kind of cute.
We got the referees scooting back a little bit.
Yeah. And this was on a stage. So it was, now I got to watch that video again sometime. That's pretty cool.
So I'm curious about your coach's mentality about training you as a weightlifter. So did your coach try to implement any habits or kind of ingrain any etiquette in you guys? Is there a difference in etiquette between how things used to be back then and how they are now, or is it more or less the same?
Not really. It's pretty much, the coach's job is to make sure you know, first of all, how to do a lift properly, and second, how to restrict yourself and not go too heavy too quickly. And that's always been kind of ingrained. They anybody I've ever worked with from back east or here, that's they have a good philosophy, and it's good to have a coach as a person to help throttle you, because if you don't, you may veer off in a different direction and not be successful. So I love having somebody else tell me. Now, I didn't used to have one, but I really enjoy it now, because somebody has to do that thinking for you.
Yeah.
So it's very helpful.
For sure. Yeah, it's definitely good to outsource. I don't think that we're particularly good observers of ourselves. You can't really be objective about your own weaknesses, because in the heat of the moment it felt just fine, and you can't tell if it was a little bit off balance,
totally.
If it feels okay to you. Totally. So it's good to have that kind of outside perspective, for sure.
Yeah.
So it seems like you've been able to kind of build a life that's really closely around your interests. I know that you do a lot of woodworking and a lot of caving, and you're always out at the meets and doing some training. So how did you kind of land yourself in a position where it seems like, from where I'm sitting, that you kind of have built a life that's really interesting to you? And I think a lot of people kind of miss out on having things that they're actually, people give up on their hobbies to grind away at the office job. But it seems like you've been able to kind of continue doing the things that you're passionate about. Did you have an intentionality to that, or what sort of advice would you have for keeping people living in line with the things that they really value?
I would say never stop doing it, be it lifting, be it woodcraft or whatever hobbies you have, or caving. Never stop doing it, because it's not only the physical aspects, but you also network with a lot of people, and if you stop doing it for a couple of years, you may lose touch with those people that help inspire you and or help encourage you to go through some of the bad times. But I'd never stop doing your hobbies, and always seek out to better yourself, to make improvements.
Okay.
Even if it's just you in the gym, or you in the workshop, or in a cave, you want to keep making improvements on you if you can. And in my case, in caving, it's not so much improving me as it is the cave that we're in, the restoration of people that have impacted in the past or broken formations is what the thing I do now is for repairs. But you keep doing it and finding ways to improve and better technology. I mean, better ways of confidence building, that type of thing.
Okay, so we kind of like to delve into like philosophical aspects of life and stuff like that on the podcast. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is like, have you developed a philosophy of life, something that's kind of guided you along the way throughout the years, whether that be in weightlifting or in your career or in your hobbies? Like, is there a way that you approach doing things and living your life the way that you find valuable and meaningful? Is there something that's guided you, like a principle or something that you've used to kind of help you do that?
I think so. I mean, always be honest, you know, with whatever you are. If you're not feeling well, you know, just always remember that, tell the truth. You know, I've always felt, you know, because you don't want to get yourself saying something that's not true, then defending it later.
Sure.
Your reputation's at stake. And I always wanted to have a good reputation and have people enjoying my opinion or company. And so, but just simply being honest with you and the people you're with too, to make sure you can give them proper feedback. You know, if not, sugarcoating something over to me never worked. So I always became disciplined in that. And also, you know, just keep working at what you like to do. I just could not say it more, is if you've got a sport you like to do, you know, make sure you follow it through. Don't get mad at something that didn't go well in the gym or workshop. And, you know, always remember that you're here, you know, to better yourself and be proud of what you did.
Yeah.
And try to encourage others too. I've always loved to help teach people, and you know, be whatever different things. When I worked at Intel, you know, I was an instructor for safety programs, and I wanted to share a lot of the knowledge that I had.
Sure.
Or in caving, teaching people how to do rope climbing. It's always to me is to be honest, but also help people. You know, just teach people what you know, and share that knowledge with my grandkids and great-grandkids too. I mean, it's always want to be there to help people get better. And I get a great sense of seeing other people achieve something too.
Okay.
You know, almost to the point, like even lifting now.
It's like a form of coaching. It's like a form of coaching.
Yeah.
It's like you're helping out somebody else improve.
Yeah, and I have no problem if they beat me or not anymore.
Sure.
It would have been an ego thing when I was younger.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, if they can do better, just to bring out the best in somebody, I think to me has always been a pleasing thing.
Okay. So well, kind of along the lines of just like, you know, everybody's winging it. Just try to do your best. Be honest about what you want, who you are up front, and then just make sure that you're striving to be better and to teach others to be better too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Admit your mistakes too. If you make a mistake, you know, say I'm wrong.
Okay.
Or say I apologize. Or think, that's always been important to me too. Be one that can say that. Because there's people out there that will never apologize.
Yeah, that's true.
And you don't want to be like that. You want to be somebody that you know, admits where there is a fault. And I think that's important too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, I think I have one question about the honesty thing. Because I think that's something that a lot of people value, but kind of fall off the wagon if they really reflect on the way that they behave, you know. So nobody likes being lied to, and nobody wants to think of themselves as a liar. But people end up getting kind of caught in these things that they don't fully anticipate, and it can be really difficult to be to be honest. Do you have any kind of you know, advice for like how to deal with, you know, being honest in an uncomfortable scenario, like something to keep in mind, like something that's helpful for you when you're. Because I'm sure that, you know, there's always the temptation of, oh, I could just kind of omit something and kind of, you know, not have to deal with this. But what do you do to make sure that you're doing the hard thing?
Remember it's going to hurt. Remember it's going to hurt to admit you're wrong. Remember it's going to hurt to be brutally honest. But if people are seeking a truthful answer, you got to give that to them. You know, even if that hurts as well. But remember, you know, our bodies are such that if we injure ourselves, it heals. So I guess you could try to heal your reputation, but remember that's a lot harder than it is to heal from a wound.
Yeah, so I agree with that. Like, people have a tendency to remember the bad things a lot longer than they remember the good things.
Oh, yeah. And remember that when you're conducting yourself in life, that remember that it's going to be you never get a second chance to make a first impression.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Type of stuff.
Yeah, and that's pretty. That's not cliche. It's like almost like a universal truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is. It is.
So, was there anything that you wanted to like bring up or talk about? Like, we still have some time, and if you wanted to bring up anything that you wanted to discuss, like you were mentioning caving, your experience with caving, like how did you get into that?
Well, my father took my sister and I to Inuit Cave in Vermont back in 1968, I think it was, and I really got interested in, I don't know, the part of being underground and bats and stuff.
Sure.
And so I started, I bought my first hard hat with some money I saved from bagging groceries back then. And so then I started seeking out other cavers that would show me kind of where the caves are.
Sure.
And I started going into the exit, the Vermont Cavers Association started not too far after that in the 70s. And I was a member of that right away, but I started learning how to do vertical work. And in fact, I went to an outward bound class to learn how to rock climb.
Okay.
And that helped me out a lot too. That was in the early 70s. And so at that point, I started being really interested in conservation too, because I'd see a lot of things that people would walk and over areas that were really pretty and leave muddy footprints on flowstone formations, for example. So I remember getting really early on and clean and restore those areas. And so it was somewhere in the 80s, it was 1986, that's right. So they had this convention, this National Speleological Society is a national body that you can join and learn about different cave trips and educational benefits too. And I joined that as a life member in 85, I believe it was, so I could network with people. But they had a restoration field camp out here in Carlsbad Caverns that year.
Okay.
So I flew out here for the first time across the Mississippi to go to this event, and
sure.
It was really neat to work with these people and learn how to clean and do restoration in caves. And so that's where I think it sparked it on. And then I started getting involved in cave cartography, which is mapping
it out. Yeah.
And it was right after then that Lechuguilla Cave, which is a large cave system down near Carlsbad Caverns, was discovered. And so we were going in there mapping that one as well. And but the restoration part has always been something I've done and throughout some national forest caves. And only 3 years ago, somebody had shown me a broken stalagmite and said that, you know, we wish we could fix this thing. And so I thought, there must be some way that we can go about doing this. And so I found a guy that had written a book, Jim Worker, and about cave conservation. And he had some ways of drilling it, of putting in stainless steel pins and to reinforce it in the epoxy that was used. So I started working on that. And so I actually found and came up with a way to support a stalactite, the ones that hang from the ceiling,
sure.
So it could be supported while the glue was being done. So I named it the Stalactajack, which is an adjustable jack with PVC and all thread that you could use to tighten it up against the formation and hold it in place. So that's become a great big deal now.
For the
last couple of years, people are all wanting to know how I come up with this device.
Sure.
And we're currently using it in a cave called Cottonwood down in the Guadalupe Mountains down there. And but it's fun to be able to fix things. For me, I always like to work on cars and woodwork and repair broken things, and this is my niche now. I think I found something that really fits, because nobody else does this. Everybody wants to come help, and I give presentations on it actually to the local cave clubs to how it's that we do this type of work down there now. It's fun.
So I'm guessing you're not afraid of the dark or small spaces.
No, no.
Like, that would be a problem if you were.
It would. It's got a good bright light and a good hard hat.
Yeah, yeah. So, and a little bit of fearlessness too, because I'm pretty sure some of those places get pretty dark and confined.
Oh, they do. You just, if you really want it bad enough, you overcome that stuff. Fear of heights, you know, for climbing.
And sure.
If you really want it, I think you can convince yourself to go work through it. So it's just, it depends how bad you want it.
Okay. Do you think that applies to weightlifting too?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It does. How bad do you want to win that gold medal?
Okay.
How bad do you want to get to the Olympics? I remember the 88 Olympics was a big deal back when, in 84, I went to that Lake Placid. And, you know, I was really thought, maybe I got to try for it. So, but the qualifying total, I got within 80 pounds of the qualifying total for the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty good, but
okay.
That was the best I could do at that time. But it was a goal.
That's still really good, though,
yeah.
within the qualifying total of the Olympics. Yeah,
yeah,
that's amazing.
So when it comes to goal setting, I think there are two kind of interesting camps, and I'm not quite sold on one or the other. But from the sounds of it, do you think it's better to set like a large aspirational goal or a short-term kind of one? So is it strive for the most you could possibly get and then see where you land, or set small step goals along the way?
No, to use that movie, What About Bob, the baby step thing.
Great role.
Yes.
Watch What About Bob.
Watch What About Bob.
Yes.
Bill Murray, excellent movie.
Yes, baby steps. And so make small goals for yourself, you know, because the big goals are great, but I mean, to achieve them, you've got to go through an awful lot to get there. A lot of different qualifiers or just personal best. And I think just set reasonable goals, such as, you know, 5 or 10 pounds in a clean and jerk or snatch, you know, or a goal of winning, you know, a state championship, or setting a record.
Yeah.
That's a realistic goal. I mean, if you can set a state record, that is an achievement, you know, and then just build it from there, thinking, okay, there's another level now. It's like walking up a ladder. You know, you don't one step to the top. You have to kind of step each one all the way up. And really, if you set your aspirations for the world championships or the Olympics, I mean, that's, you're going to be depressed, because there's a lot of people out there with really some good strength and talent.
True. There's a very, very good pool of people with a lot of strength and talent. So.
Yeah.
That kind of like reminds me of our logo, the Sisyphus. Is like,
if you're pushing that boulder up the hill, if you just look at where the hill lies and just see how long you have to get there, it's just going to seem like such a daunting, exhausting task. But if you're just pushing, just working on focusing, pushing the boulder up little by little, eventually you'll get to the top.
Maybe steps. There
but
you
it
go.
Just takes a little bit to get there, and just some focus on maybe doing the small things right.
Realistic goals at first, yes, for sure.
Do you feel like weightlifting, kind of like learning how to set those realistic goals and training for sport, kind of allowed you to set the goals in your personal life? You know, like, do you see a carryover between the two?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's like a habit. You develop that habit of taking small increments and gains, and it works in other parts of your life. Financially.
Financially, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to make a big savings or make a big purchase on a house, you've got to take it small and do realistic goals. I mean, you're just going to be depressed if you think you can do something quickly. You know, it's just save over time.
Sure.
Save in the bank of life.
Yeah,
it seems to work that way for me.
Yeah, and that seems to be the way that life works in general, is like small things happen in small increments over time. It's not we don't usually get like big changes right at once. It's usually just small things happening over a long period of time.
Absolutely.
And that makes a change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, so I don't have anything else. Did you want to add anything, Grayson, or do you have any more questions?
No, I mean, I think that we covered a lot of interesting ground, and it's awesome to have you on. It's been a lot of fun talking about, you know, like life lessons from lifting and a little bit about how you got your start. I think we might have lifted together in my first or second competition, and we just did it again last week, and I look forward to lifting with you more often, man. It's always great to have you out, and
I'm glad
you were able to come down to the gym today and do a little bit of squatting and kind of get a feel for the space. And,
wonderful space. Wonderful place you've got here.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. Is there anything else you want to share, Mike? Is there anything you're working on that you'd like to maybe make people aware of, or anything that you'd like to bring up before we close it out?
I can't think of anything specific now.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you for coming on and sharing your experience with us and taking the time to do that and taking the time to come out and train with us, too. That was really good to have you in here. So that concludes today's podcast, everybody. So if you catch us next time, you can always drop us an email at asaweightlifting@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram. But we hope you enjoyed this podcast, and we hope you get something out of it. Until next time, happy lifting, y'all.
Take care.
Thanks.